From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, hate crimes in America. The FBI says that 2019 was the deadliest year on record. Our guest, Becky Monroe, director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. According to its website, the Leadership Conference is the nation's oldest, largest, and most diverse civil and human rights coalition committed to the protection and advancement of civil and human rights for every person in the United States. Since its inception in 1950, the Leadership Conference has lobbied for and won the passage of the Civil Rights Acts of 1957, 1960, and 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. It also helped to organize the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in August 1963, which was a defining event for the civil rights movement in the 20th century. On this edition of the program, we will talk with Becky Monroe about the findings in the 2019 FBI hate crimes report, which shows a 113% increase in hate crime murders since 2018. There were more than 7,300 hate crimes reported in 2019. According to the Leadership Conference, the number of law enforcement agencies voluntarily reporting their figures has decreased, which means the 2019 report only captures a fraction of the actual incidences of hate crimes. Race-based crimes comprise the largest number of incidences. As in previous years, anti-black crimes were the highest percentage of violent hate crime incidences, accounting for nearly 50% of reported offenses. There was a 14% increase in anti-Semitic hate crime, and anti-Latino crimes increased for the fourth straight year in a row. Prior to joining the Leadership Conference, Becky Monroe worked at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She also worked within the Obama administration, where she served as the Director for Policy and Planning and Senior Counselor to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. And we're delighted to welcome Becky Monroe to tell us more about the factors behind the number of hate crimes in America and what practical steps can be taken to combat this trend. And Becky Monroe joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thank you, Becky. Please give us a bit more background into the current mission of the Leadership Conference. How has it adapted to today's challenges?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, the Leadership Conference, it is a coalition, and we're charged by our diverse membership of more than 220 national organizations to promote and protect the civil and human rights of all people in the United States. So as a coalition, we have this strength in our diversity and strength in the membership organizations that have really responded to this moment that you're describing now in terms of the increase in hate incidents and hate crimes in a way that is consistent with our history of leading by respecting the sort of community-centered approach to addressing hate. So what I mean by that is, you know, as we see these alarming numbers, and you talked about the fact that the FBI, based on its data, has noted that this is the deadliest year on record for hate crimes, we also know that hate is not new. The organizations that we are proud to represent as a part of this coalition have been fighting racism, fighting other forms of discrimination for generations. And so part of what we have done is, as we've seen this increase in the sense of really the sense of emboldenment among groups that are promoting hate, is to call on the expertise and experience of people who have been confronting and combating racism and other forms of discrimination for many years. So at the Fighting Hate and Bias Project, which I lead here at the Leadership Conference, we are working specifically on addressing this increase in hate with a respect for the fact that the hate is not new, but that people are feeling newly emboldened to commit acts of hate. And one of the things we're doing to do that is to recognize the ways in which people who are targeted for hate are often targeted at the intersection of different forms of their identity. So one campaign that we're very proud of that we've been working on is called Black Justice is Our Justice. Part of the idea of this campaign is trying to really recognize there's a unique history within the United States, and it's a history that must be reckoned with if we are to address both anti-blackness, but also other forms of racism and other forms of discrimination in this country. So we talk about the fact that in order to fight anti-Semitism, we have to fight anti-blackness. In order to fight anti-Asian American hatred, we have to fight anti-blackness. And that's in part due to the unique sort of way that our country was founded. It was founded both with the genocide of Native Americans, but also on slavery. And so thinking about sort of how we as a coalition really are working together to make sure that the United States is a country that can live up to its ideals, that is as good as the promise of its ideals. So that's some of the way that we've been trying to think about this moment, but really respect the historical context that brought us here.
Well, thank you for that, Becky. And I think it's important to mention this intersection of religion, race, and ethnicity. And certainly, as far as anti-Semitism in this country, Jews are not a part of what we would call the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group, which has been, at least until recently, the majority culture in America. So if I understand it, a hate crime is a crime that manifests evidence of prejudice based on race, religion, sexual orientation, or ethnicity. So with that, let's go to the 2019 FBI hate crimes report. What is your biggest takeaway from that? Why has it been described as the deadliest on record?
The reason is it is described as the deadliest on record is that the number of murders that are connected to hate crimes almost doubled. That is the highest number since data has been captured. It is important to note that 2019 was also the year of the El Paso massacre, when a white nationalist specifically targeted the Latino community and murdered Latinos in El Paso, and that the number of people who were murdered in that one incident is part of why it was the deadliest year. 2019 was also a deadly year for many other communities. You noted anti-Semitism continues to be, actually this year it increased and it continues to be on the increase. Some of the murders were also included in anti-Semitic hate crimes. So the reason it is called the deadliest year is that in fact, it is the highest number of hate crime murders that we have seen on record since hate crimes data was captured. One note I want to make, and I think it's important to note at the beginning when we're talking about this data, is that the data in and of itself we know is underreported. And I'm happy to kind of talk a little bit about why we know that's underreported. But I think it's important to note that understanding that the data is underreported, we are still seeing 2019 as the deadliest year. The other thing I think that bears mentioning here is that we're talking about the 2019 data that just came out a couple weeks ago. This is not unique to this administration. Historically, it takes about a year and a half for the data to come out. So we're talking about 2019 data in November of 2020. We will talk about 2020 data in November of next year. And I think the reason I note that is that data drives policy. Data drives resources. Data helps us understand where we should be investing both in responding to hate incidents and hate crimes, but also in helping communities prepare and potentially prevent hate crimes. So I think that's something that's important to note as well. And finally, I think if we're looking at what's notable here, it's not only the devastating increases in hate overall number of hate crimes, the devastating number of people who were murdered in a hate crime, but I think it's also the fact that the number of law enforcement agencies that reported hate crimes in the United States decreased. So again, we're seeing an increase in hate crimes overall, an increase in deadly hate crimes, at the same time that we're seeing fewer police departments participate in this data collection. That is a problem. The data collection is voluntary, and when law enforcement agencies do not report or affirmatively report zero hate crimes occurring, that not only doesn't provide the accurate information that law enforcement would need to effectively address the problem, it also sends a very clear message to communities that are targeted for hate that this may not be a priority for the people who, in theory, are charged to protect them.
Becky, I want to pick up on this point about the voluntary nature of the submission of data. As you said, and as has been reported, the data is underreported in 2019. So the fact that hate crimes are on the rise is very disturbing, because it could even be worse if we had more reporting. Why is the submission of data by law enforcement agencies voluntary and not mandatory?
The reason that law enforcement agencies report, it's connected to legislation in the United States, the Hate Crime Statistics Act. Now, the Hate Crime Statistics Act makes it mandatory for the FBI to attempt to collect the data, but it is voluntary for agencies to report. The question you're asking is a question that we are hearing from many advocates and other communities across the country, because again, we know this data is underreported. One way we know the data is underreported is that the FBI collects this data voluntarily from agencies. One data point is that 86% of law enforcement agencies in this country, and there are about 18,000 law enforcement agencies across the United States, 86% affirmatively report that zero hate crimes occurred in their jurisdiction. Historically, this has included states like the state of Alabama. It has included large cities. We know that statistically this is not possible, that there are in fact zero hate crimes in many of these states and these cities. You know, the fact that one, that it's voluntary to participate, but the people are affirmatively reporting zero is a problem. The second point I think it's important to note is that the same Department of Justice that reports this data, so again, the FBI is a part of the Department of Justice in the United States, the same DOJ has another component called the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And that department has conducted what they call the National Crime Victimization Survey, NCVS. So the NCVS data is data that is actually based on a sampling system of surveys. So the same Department of Justice that says, yeah, the data is about 7,000, around a little bit more than 7,000 hate crimes in a year, that same department says actually, using the NCVS sampling methodology, it's closer to 250,000 on average. That difference speaks volumes. The difference between around 7,000 and 250,000 is not just number of people who've been targeted, but it's entire communities. Because I think one of the unique things about hate incidents and hate crimes is that while they may appear to be targeting an individual or one person, they are really targeting a community. For example, in the hate crime in El Paso, he was targeting Latino shoppers at the store. He was really targeting Latinos across the country, and indeed across the world in many ways. When we look at other incidents of hate crimes and look at the data around sort of who's impacted and people who are directly affected, part of what is devastating about hate crime is it really is intended to be a message crime. It's intended to target others. So when you have this data disparity, again, it not only sends messages to communities about who counts, what kind of crimes matter, but it also makes it really difficult for law enforcement and for social service providers to know where to focus their resources. We cannot address a problem, we cannot, just in the same way we can't address an epidemic, without having the data. So, you know, for that reason, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about what groups are trying to do to address this data gap, but that's why it's voluntary, that's why we know that it's underreported, and that's why there are so many advocates, hate crimes survivors, family members of hate crime victims that are really focused on this data piece. Because I know at first blush people think, why are you talking about data and numbers? We're talking about people and lives. The reason is that these numbers translate into actions in terms of what our government can do and in terms of what our communities can do to support people targeted for hate.
Can we do something? Can we force law enforcement agencies to do a better job of reporting? Or is it that they have problem identifying a hate crime from a different crime? Would that make a difference if there's some sort of legislation that would require all law enforcement agencies, not just 12% of them or however many actually reported, to actually report these crimes?
There are a couple of different things that could help. And I think one effort that I want to highlight is, it's called the Jabara Hire No Hate Act. And it is named after two people who were murdered in hate crimes, but whose deaths were not recorded as hate crimes in the FBI data. It's named after Khalid Jabara, who was a young Arab American man who was murdered on the front steps of his own home by a white supremacist neighbor, whose actions and whose bias towards him and his family had been noted by law enforcement. And yet he was murdered, and it was prosecuted as a hate crime. It was in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is my home city. It was not reported as a hate crime in the FBI hate crimes data. The other person is named after is Heather Heyer. And Heather was a young woman who was protesting racial injustice in Charlottesville and who was run over by a white supremacist. And again, her murder was also charged as a hate crime, but that data was not reported as a hate crime. So I think the idea is that the legislation there would provide very strong incentives for law enforcement to report. It would also make it easier for people who are involved in the prosecution of hate crimes to identify other ways of addressing hate incidents and hate crimes. So in addition to prosecution, in addition to using the hate crime statutes that we have available, thinking further about sort of more community-based practices and restorative practices. So that's one option. I think that it is certainly possible for the U.S. Congress to pass a law that makes it mandatory, and that would make it so that law enforcement agencies had to report that data. Finally, I will say I am a member of the Civil Rights Subcommittee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and I have worked with law enforcement leaders across the country who recognize the ways in which hate crimes devastate their communities, who recognize that they have a higher obligation to address those issues, and who are looking for ways to improve their response to hate incidents and hate crimes. And so I think there are departments that recognize this. We have worked with law enforcement agencies across the country to train both to identify hate crimes as well as the importance of reporting them. So I think when we talk about the reason for the low numbers, I think it's important to both think about, as you noted, do law enforcement agencies recognize hate crimes when they see them so that they can report them effectively? And then do they actually in fact report them? But I think the other issue that perhaps we can discuss a little bit later is understanding that many communities who are targeted for hate, if law enforcement is not called, they may not feel safe to call law enforcement. So another reason that we have underreporting is that people don't feel safe reporting to law enforcement. And I think that's for many ongoing and historic reasons.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Becky Monroe, Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. That's the nation's oldest civil rights coalition dedicated to the advancement of civil and human rights for every person in the United States. We're discussing the findings in the 2019 FBI hate crimes report. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to one of our loyal listeners, Cra Emanuel, who resides in San Nicola Arcella, Italy. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Also, please tune in Saturday and Sunday to our sister program, Encounter. I'll talk with two Latin American experts about the deteriorating political and economic conditions in the once prosperous oil-rich country of Venezuela. The Maduro regime conducted elections for the National Assembly, which were boycotted by the opposition and widely viewed as illegitimate by the majority of Latin American countries, the United States, and Europe. That's the Latin American edition of Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. And now back to our special guest, Becky Monroe, Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Crimes Programs at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Let's turn now to the factors that are behind this ugly trend in the rise in hate crimes. You know, generally speaking, we're seeing here in this country hyper-partisanship, extreme polarization. I think the pandemic has exacerbated this. Socioeconomic inequality is on the rise. Tribalism, I guess, is a good word for what we're experiencing. But other analysts also point to an embrace of incitement or the demonization of the other. We're seeing that, you know, in anti-immigrant rhetoric, even elements of current political leadership, people using code words like globalists, describing George Soros as some boogeyman. He's a Jewish philanthropist and financier. But let me get you to help us understand what's going on and to what extent we're seeing more and more white nationalist groups and white supremacist groups perhaps feeling emboldened.
I think you've identified many of the factors. I think one thing, and I said this at the beginning and it warrants repeating, we know that hate is not new, but we also do know that due to political leadership, people do feel newly emboldened to act on hate. And so while white supremacy and white nationalism is not new in this country, it has been here since our founding, we know that with the encouragement of leaders at the top of the country and the demonization of people who are targeted for hate, it has in fact emboldened people to act, to commit more acts of hate. I think if you look at the data, even for 2019, as problematic as it is and as underreported as it is, the increase in hate crimes targeting the Latino community, that is a clear sign. I think when we look to 2020 data next year, I think that if the data is somewhat accurate, we will see an increase in hate incidents and hate crimes targeting Asian Americans, and that is connected in some parts to the pandemic because of fear mongering by political leaders purporting to blame Asian Americans for this disease and resulting in the targeting of Asian Americans for hate crimes. So I think there's no question that while it is not new, there is a new sense of emboldenment. And I think it's also important to note that the pandemic, in many ways, for people who had the privilege to not acknowledge or to address, whether it was racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim bias, anti-LGBT hatred, this pandemic has removed any opportunity to say that we didn't know. When you look at the numbers of people who are dying in this country, in the United States right now, the disproportionate number of Black and Brown communities that are suffering is directly connected to racism. It's directly connected to who gets resources and who gets support and how that sort of racism has been institutionalized. And you cannot help but look at that when you're trying to understand acts of hate and hate violence. That kind of climate that is created and that is emboldened by people fear-mongering is really critical to understand. You know, at the leadership conference, that's part of why we, when we started the Black Justice is Our Justice campaign, recognizing again that Black justice really is all of our justice, that if we cannot address anti-Blackness, we cannot address other forms of hatred. We worked with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, or BAJI, and part of it was just talking to them about the experience of confronting both anti-Blackness and anti-immigrant hatred at a time when both are being ratcheted up. And so part of our goal with that was both to highlight that reality and to let people understand the devastating impacts that racism and the anti-immigrant discrimination can have, and to make sure that we were, that communities, that they were being recognized not only because they had to confront that kind of hatred and racism, but also to be recognized for their strength and the beauty and the joy in families that have come to this country, sometimes seeking opportunity for their families and for their children, and the contributions that they make to this country, and also sort of heralding that and celebrating that.
We are supposed to be and are a country of immigrants, so we need to, you know, look at that component of our makeup. Becky Monroe, I wonder if you could address the role of social media platforms, to what extent they just amplify some of this rhetoric, the hate and discrimination that we're seeing, unfortunately, increasing in this country.
There's no question that social media platforms both have the potential and indeed have actually increased hate activity on and off the platform. And I think it is important to reckon with that and to hold platforms accountable for what they are doing to address hate activity on their platforms. I think it's also important to note that social media can be used by communities that are targeted for hate to push back. But I think that, you know, one of the things the leadership conference that we have been doing is talking about how do you hold these platforms accountable, like Facebook, like Twitter, to make sure that they are sort of living up to their obligation as a company that is often a purveyor of both hate as well as of groups that are trying to combat hate. And so I think there are many ways that we can try to address some of that hate online, and that it is critical to addressing this problem, especially during a pandemic when there's more and more activity online.
What other practical tools do you recommend to bridge divides and fight back against hate crimes and hate mongering? You know, what strategies can people of goodwill adopt?
There are a few different things. So one is I would include people to come to blackjusticeisourjustice.org. You can find it. It's more information about our campaign. But there we are continuing to both lift up the work of groups around this country and really around the world that are working to lift up the contributions, for example, of immigrants that are looking to both speak up and condemn hate when they see it. I think there's some really practical things that people can do. So for example, if you're concerned about whether or not where you are living, your jurisdiction is reporting hate crimes, you can join with other groups that are saying, it is important that you report this. It is important to me as somebody who lives in this city. When someone's reporting zero hate crimes, it sends a message. And people have been organizing around the country to make sure that they are making their voices heard to their local law enforcement and to mayors and to others. Online, there are many organizations that are sort of looking how you combat hate online. One of the ways that people are doing that is to both recognize disinformation, don't amplify it if you could avoid that. And that means, you know, information that is purposely trying to sort of to spread misinformation, to spread lies, to spread hate, don't propagate it. But also online, there are many more groups that are working together just to make sure they're fighting back and supporting people who are targeted for hate. So there are many actions that people can take both in their community. One of the most important things I would say is that if people are targeted for hate, figure out how you can support the organizations that where people go to. So whether it's a local LGBT center, a local mosque, a local synagogue, those are the places where people who are targeted for hate, that's where they go, that's who they trust. And so to the extent that people can support those organizations and those entities, that's how you can make sure you're both supporting people who are targeted for hate and listen to them about what they need, both to feel safe and to push back.
Becky Monroe, before we go, one more question to you. Let's just take a quick look at the macro political level. You know, we are in a transition, a political transition to the Biden administration. President-elect Biden has talked about unity, that he wants to try to bring the country together in light of so many divisions. Are you relatively optimistic? How much influence can that type of rhetoric and perhaps subsequent action, what type of influence can that have on depressing this trend of hate crimes and getting more reporting and doing more to combat that? What are you recommending your organization, if you are, to the Biden administration, a larger strategy?
Absolutely. I am optimistic, and honestly, my optimism stems both from this opportunity for change, but also from the communities that we have had the privilege of working with and seeing the ways in which they have pushed back, whether it was through this election to make sure that people were able to vote and had their voices heard, or through the ways that people have come together to support communities that have been targeted for hate. So, for example, we have seen communities come across, whether it's racial justice organizations, religious organizations coming to support, for example, the Asian American community that was seeing an increase in hate. It's also coming from the Black leadership we've seen pushing back against police brutality and people protesting in the streets and really demanding accountability and justice. So I am hopeful. We have submitted our transition recommendations to the Biden administration, and they include both some very specific things around hate crimes data collection, some of the issues we talked about how the Department of Justice right now could improve hate crimes data collection by working with state and local law enforcement agencies. It includes support for legislation like the Jabara Hire No Hate Act. And it also includes really using the bully pulpit. And I do think it matters. As I mentioned, hate is not new and hate is not going to suddenly disappear. But the people who have been fighting hate, the African-American organizations, the other racial justice organizations, the Jewish organizations, Muslim organizations, LGBTQ leaders, the disability rights community, they will make sure that we work together to combat hate, and they will make sure and hold accountable the next administration to make sure they are using their what we call the bully pulpit or just their leadership opportunity. What leaders say matters. We have seen that, and we can see it the other way. We can see it both in the terms of people feeling emboldened to commit acts of hate, but we know that we can also see it in terms of communities coming together to support each other. So I think, you know, when we talk about division, sometimes division is important and is a good force for change in terms of people highlighting, for example, systemic racism. That is important. And the fact that it may divide people, that is something that we as a country need to confront. We need to confront the fact that we still have systemic racism in this country. That kind of division is good. And that kind of division can be productive when people confront our history, confront the truth about ongoing systemic racism, and then use that to really change and move our country forward. So I am optimistic about that. I think that new leadership will help to make sure that we are sort of seizing on that, recognizing that the richness of our country comes from our diversity, comes from immigrants, comes from the extraordinary contributions of Black people, comes from the contributions of Jews and Muslims across this country, from LGBTQ Americans who have made countless sacrifices and contributions, and that we are stronger as a country when we confront the truth about an ongoing history of racism and discrimination, and we use that to bring us closer to our founding ideals.
Becky Monroe is Director of the Immigrant Rights and Fighting Hate and Bias Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.